Hello, and welcome to episode 3.13, the March 20th, 2024 Ostara edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. Ostara is the Wiccan name for the vernal equinox, the beginning of spring. Of course, in Western New York, spring never magically appears when the calendar says it does. Looking at the 10-day forecast ahead, it doesn't look particularly spring-like. I find I get really antsy this time of year, as the idea of what spring is in my head doesn't quite match what spring actually is doing outside. I'm ready to get out there and get in the yard or ride my bike, but the reality of a 40-degree day with a wind chill of 32 degrees and gray skies soon slaps me in the face and drives me back inside. So I'll have to be content for the moment, putting in my annual order of onion sets and seed potatoes, and wait for them to arrive, so that at the first opportunity I get, I can get out there and get them in the ground. I'll be more than ready when that day comes. The 2023-24 season at the Metropolitan Opera House continues with the production of Charles Gounod's 1867 operatic classic Roméo et Juliette. This production features a fabulous cast of singers, and for this discussion I spoke with the newest member of the voice faculty at SUNY Fredonia School of Music, Mr. Donald Marazzo, to get his insights into the opera. Okay, well, we are going to talk about the upcoming production live at the Met, Saturday, March 23rd at 1 p.m. at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. And I feel quite fortunate because I reached out to Donald Marazzo. He is the director of opera studies at SUNY Fredonia. He is also the producer of the Hillman Opera. This is his first year on the voice faculty at SUNY Fredonia. So welcome, Don. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, yeah. And you and I had a nice little chat beforehand. I mean, I think this is really going to be a very fun interview and bring you around. But let's start off a little bit about you. Because I'm sure my listeners are going to want to know a little bit. It's your first year, and you did a production of The Fledermaus in the fall. They threw you right into the fire. They wasted no time.
Right into the fire, exactly. So I joined the faculty here at Fredonia in late August. And just a couple days after, we started rehearsals for Fledermaus. It was a wonderful production, and I was really, really delighted to be part of that. So prior to coming to Fredonia, I had spent 6 years living and working abroad. From 2017 to 21, I was running the classical voice department at the conservatory in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, and teaching voice there as well. And then from 21 to 23, I was running the classical voice department and teaching voice at the Musical Horizons Conservatory in Athens, Greece. So this is my first, my move back to the States, and I'm thrilled to be back. The faculty is incredible. The students are just fantastic. And it's a really genuinely supportive, nurturing environment to be in. And in a way, it's kind of, I lament a little bit that it's kind of this best kept secret, because Fredonia is an outstanding school of music. And so we're working hard now to make sure that even more people know about it, because it's really a remarkable place.
Oh, not good. I'm glad to hear you say that. I have a great love for the university myself. So it's nice to hear people coming in fresh, just to hearing the same thing. Got any good plans for the Hillman Opera coming up?
I do. You know, it's a very exciting time in the voice area here at Fredonia. So when I interviewed here, the search committee and the upper administration shared with me that building our master's degree in voice program and creating more national and international collaborations would be of prime importance should I come to Fredonia. And I'm really thrilled to say that in just the few months that I've been here, we've made great strides in those areas through strategic recruitment initiatives. Our master's program in voice enrollment will increase by approximately 400% for the coming year,
Wow.
which is incredible, yes. And that will include students from France, Malaysia, Greece. In fact, the student that we are, I believe, will be coming from Greece, was just named a Fulbright scholarship recipient. And it's the first time in the history of Fredonia that the Fulbright Foundation has supported a student to come to study at Fredonia. We have had students graduating from Fredonia who've gotten Fulbrights elsewhere, but this is a wonderful, wonderful honor for the student and endorsement of the great work that we're doing here in Fredonia that Fulbright is supporting her to come here to study. So that's very exciting, certainly for the master's program. And we are working to continue to develop the most comprehensive curriculum for that program, for the master's in voice program, and making great strides there. As director of opera studies and Hillman Opera producer, I'm very aware of the landscape of today's opera industry, and we're working to make sure that the Fredonia's opera curriculum will fully prepare students to meet the demands of the industry as it stands today. So, to that end, we are very aware of the industry's commitment right now to contemporary works and works by living composers. We see that certainly even at the Met with Dead Man Walking and Fire Shut Up in My Bones and Akhenaten and all of these pieces that are selling out much more quickly even than the more standard pieces. And so we're very aware that is not unique only to the Met. It is happening internationally. The audiences crave works that feel very current and relevant to them by living composers. And so we are committing to that much more as part of our curriculum through the voice area and through Hillman. So we will be doing new works by living composers. And in fact, we just did a world premiere workshop of a piece called Having Guests for Dinner by Nicholas Bentz and Robert Fung that happened on February 18th. We did that in collaboration with the Western New York Chamber Orchestra and with Core Productions. And that was a wonderful success with the composer and the librettist here in attendance for that. We will, of course, also certainly continue to program the more standard operatic repertoire, which is a foundation for developing our students' techniques and their musicianship and their capabilities on stage. We will further pursue collaborations with Winnico, Western New York Chamber Orchestra, and the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. We are incorporating vocal coaching into our curriculum, weekly vocal coaching for the students, increased performance opportunities. And we just started this year, which I had designed and am very excited to be teaching Opera Seminar 1 and 2 classes. The classes have existed for a number of years, but we've recently change the content for the course curriculum. And so now it will focus on a number of areas of opera training, including all four periods of opera, so Baroque, classical, romantic, and 20th and 21st century music, the study of voice types in America and abroad, entrepreneurship, audition training, mock auditions for the students, and one-on-one individual coaching sessions on arias from the Baroque, classical, romantic, and 20th and 21st century periods, so that when the students get out of here, they feel truly equipped to get out and successfully audition for the opera industry, be it for master's degree programs, studio training programs, agents, companies, etc. So there are a lot of exciting plans for our opera program here.
You are off to a running start, young man.
Thank you. We're running, and it's exciting. Yeah, it's
It
exciting.
sounds very exciting. Congratulations. That's really good to hear. All of it's very
Thank
good
you.
to hear.
Thank you.
As far as that's concerned, we've got a little piece here from the classical repertoire, of course, to talk about, and that's Romeo Juliet by Charles Gounod. That's what's coming up for us. So let's talk about that a little bit now, get our audiences prepared to take a look at that particular opera. It is I don't know if I'm saying this correctly, but it is Gounod's second best opera. Most people, note him for his Faust, but this one is his second best opera, shall we say? But I think it's pretty good.
That's correct. I think it's a hit. Absolutely. So yes, you're absolutely right. So we would say in American English, Charles Gounod, but the French would say Charles Gounod. And he was a French composer. He wrote prolifically for church music, songs, orchestral music, and opera. I think he wrote 12 operas. And his, you're absolutely right. His most popular is Faust, or as the French say, Faust. And his second is Romeo et Juliet, and it remains definitely part of the international repertory. So it's wildly popular. And I would say probably the most popular setting, there have been several composers who've set Romeo and Juliet to opera, of course, in opera. And I would say that his is probably the most popular and well-known.
Yeah, there's no real need actually to talk about the story. I think everybody is probably going to know what the story is and all of that.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about the music. There's actually a couple of pieces that probably people would hear, and they'll hear it and they go, oh, I recognize that, but I didn't know it was from that opera.
That's right. That's right. So what Gounod does really beautifully is that he infuses Romeo and Juliet with a really elegant music style, a writing style that reflects the writing of the original story, right? So there's tremendous wordplay and elegance in the original story, the Shakespearean story, and he reflects that, Gounod reflects that in the writing. It's very interesting because the Gounod composition, this composition of this opera, is it's very much admired for its contrast of light and dark in the score, of like lighter moments and then very heavy dramatic moments. And so midway through Act One, Juliet takes the stage with this amazing coloratura. For anybody who doesn't know what coloratura is, it's very fast moving, glittery, kind of quick notes. And she does this piece called Je veux vivre, which is this big tour de force vocally and very sparkling and bright and coloratura and all of that. But then later in the opera, before she drinks the poison, spoiler alert, but we know she drinks the poison. Okay, right. So she sings what we would call an opera, the poison aria, which is Amour anime mon courage. And that's an extremely dramatic, dark, heavy piece. So what is a bit typical with works in the Romantic period, and we see this with certainly Romeo and Juliet, but you see it in Rigoletto by Verdi, and you see it in La Traviata, and you see it especially for the soprano writing, is the lead soprano has this, in the first act, this very brilliant, spectacular, high, bright, light aria, like Sempre Libera in Traviata, or Caro Nome in Rigoletto, or Je veux vivre in Romeo and Juliet. And then after that, the role becomes very heavy and dramatic. So it almost takes like two different kinds of voices that you have to sing this role, these roles, but housed in one person. And so actually this kind of vocal writing is extraordinarily difficult for the soprano in particular. And this Gounod Romeo and Juliet is no exception in terms of that kind of writing for the soprano. But there are wonderful, wonderful pieces in here. There are four really irresistible duets between the principal characters. And of course, then the Je veux vivre, like I said, this wonderful glittery coloratura soprano showpiece, which many people know upon hearing, even if they don't know that it's from this opera. And even, which is interesting, amongst these four duets, there's a brief final reunion in the tomb scene between the two characters, a musical reunion that does not happen in the play, in the original play. So it's extraordinarily beautiful music, and I think people will love it, really love it.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to listen to you talk about it musically, because from a point of view of having been in a number of productions, and I think directed two of them myself, it's exactly the same in terms of the writing of the play, because the play is just light and lovely and poetic and wonderful at the beginning. And then when all the tragedy happens in that act and everybody dies, it just turns so dark. And it's exactly the same thing. You're asking those actors to, you know, just sort of switch on to completely different sides of themselves to be able to get it. And I think it's an element that most people don't recognize in terms of the actual storyline.
Yes, and that's exactly right. And so you're absolutely right, Tom. It is extraordinarily difficult for the actors who are doing a play in that way. And now you add to this an opera, the extraordinary range of the voices, the dynamics of the voices, singing over, you know, an 80 or 100 piece orchestra without amplification, all of these things. So it's extraordinarily difficult to start with in play format, and then to add all of these other elements into it. It's really kind of Olympian what's being asked of singers in this. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And it's very hard to do. Extremely difficult. I want to talk a little bit about the talent in this particular opera, because I listened to Nadine Sierra sing. Yeah. And I mean, she just blew me away. And when you talk about, you know, a soprano voice that needs to be light at the beginning, but dramatic at the end. Huh. Wow. Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, she is remarkable. She's, you know, it's fascinating with her. I mean, she's an extraordinarily beautiful woman, first of all. So when you see her, she just is Juliet. When you see her, she's exactly what you would imagine. Her voice is outstanding. Her technique is outstanding. Dramatically, she is outstanding. I was present. It's interesting. I was present in 2009 when she won the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions when she was 21 years old. And it was already evident that she was going to be a world star. You know, I had heard about her even before the Met competition. There were already, you know, kind of rumblings about her, and, you know, this quiet, like, well, we hear somebody coming up through the ranks, who already, I think from 15, 16, 17 years old, she was studying and had her eyes set on an opera career. And she's just remarkable, absolutely remarkable. And I spoke to colleagues recently who saw this production in the house, the Romeo and Juliet, and they just said, she was extraordinary in every way. There was just not anything more that you could have wanted from her, vocally, dramatically, anything. That it was just quintessential. It was just perfect.
Yeah, so. She does it all, because from the coloratura to the dramatic, she has a high note at the end of that Poison speech. I don't even know what that note is.
I know.
Amazing. I don't get paid enough to know what that note is.
I know. I see several high C's in that, and then a sustained final high B flat, and she just nails it. It's the most beautiful thing. And not just beautiful, impassioned, and just so visceral, the impact of what she's doing. Incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible. And the tenor who's playing Romeo, Benjamin Bernheim, he's another star whose voice, the clarity in that tenor is, I think, is outstanding too.
It's really beautiful. It's wonderful. I think he made his Met debut last season in Rigoletto. And from what I hear from colleagues, and certainly in any reviews I've read anything recently, that his Romeo is even more successful and convincing vocally and interpretively. He is French. So, of course, the way that he feels and produces language is very different than probably everybody else in the cast, because this is native for him. The language is native. So.
Yeah, there was some picked on poor Nadine. She said her French diction wasn't all that. Maybe wasn't all that good. But they were French people who were mentioning
exactly. French. I know, right? They're kind of, well, and this is an interesting point. It's so interesting that you bring that up, Tom, because, you know, there's something very interesting. If maybe people viewing the broadcast will catch this, but certainly people in music will know this, that, and certainly people in a voice specialty will notice this, is that in America, and in many countries, not just America, but we are trained to sing French with a flipped R. So where you do like ra 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 ra, the tongue of the tip of the tongue is flipping the R, like you would almost say D, like D, ra ra ra. And in French native speakers use a uvular R. So they say at the back of the throat, right? We are trained to flip it in the front, because in singing, the last thing you want is rear tongue tension. You don't want the back of the tongue to be like doing that. If you listen to this production, it's fascinating. When you listen, Nadine Sierra is flipping the R. Most of the, she is doing what is trained in most countries. Benjamin Bernheim is doing a uvular R. He is doing it as you would do it in native French speaking. So there is really a contrast between how they're doing it. And so, of course, native French speakers are going to hear him and say, but it's perfect. You know, he's doing it perfect, because it's as they would hear it in French. They don't flip R's really in speaking it. So for her, I'm sure they're like, what is this? You know, she's flipping there. But I think she does it beautifully. And I think he probably just does it more idiomatically, let's say, like what they're used to hearing in natural French speech.
Right, right. Yeah. That makes a perfect lot of sense. But what an interesting thing to bring to the experience of listening to this particular opera. You know, There's really a lot of talent. And I think that one of the things that the audiences that are going to come to see this are really going to enjoy, first of all, they'll all know the story. So it's not a problem with the storyline. I think that's pretty clear. The talent on the stage, not just Nadine and Benjamin, but you've also got Alfred Walker, Frederick Ballantyne, and especially Will Liverman is Mercutio. He's a wonderful singer. And they even have, I believe, Samantha Hanke in the pants role of Stefano.
Yes, they do. And Eve Gigliotti is Gertrude, which is interesting because my father was her first grade teacher. And I have known Eve Gigliotti since we were kids. I used to see her in like musical theater productions in high schools and stuff like that. I mean, it's an amazing, I love that you bring them up also the quote unquote supporting cast, but they are also principals actually as well. I mean, this is a small cast and they are, you know, Alfred Walker is Frère Laurent. I mean, these are like major amazing singers. And as you said, Will Liverman, who is not only an amazing composer, we had him I used to work at Glimmerglass Opera and he was in the Young Artist Program there in 2010. He's not only an amazing singer, he's a wonderful composer. There are Lyric Opera of Chicago, the Met, these companies are starting to produce works by him that he's also composed. So it's an incredibly rich cast across the board. Just amazing.
Wonderful. That's going to make it more amazing for the audiences. Don, thank you so much for your time, your expertise. It's just wonderful to get to know you and listen to you talk about opera. It's great. I think the students at Fredonia are probably glad to have you, and I'm certainly glad to have you on the program. So thanks for coming.
I can't thank you enough for having me. Thank you very much.
The Live at the Met presentation of Romeo e Julieta will be presented Saturday, March 24th, 2024, beginning at 1 p.m. Tickets are $20 for adults, $18 for Opera House members, and $10 for students. For tickets, go online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or call the box office at 716-679-1891. Live at the Met is underwritten with support from Daniel S. Kaufman and Timothy W. Beaver. To have an encounter with any of the visual arts is almost always to have an encounter with yourself. Artist Leila Ali, whose drawings are currently on exhibit at the Marion Art Gallery and feature a retrospective of her career, has created several series of drawings that run from the deceptively simple to the meticulously complex, exploring ideas of race, gender, and cultural intersectionality. I spoke with her about my reactions to her work and how she herself sees it across a 30-year career. Joining me now to talk about her exhibit at the Kathy and Marion Art Gallery on the SUNY Fredonia campus in the Rockefeller Art Center is artist Leila Ali. Her current exhibition over at the Marion Art Gallery is called Is Anything the Matter? And it will be there until April 14th. And she herself is coming to give a lecture on her exhibit on March 22nd. So, Leila, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, and hello.
Now, as we talk about your work and the kind of stylistic thing that you do, I was enthralled, first of all, when I went to see the exhibit. It was quite interesting, powerful. I mean, I have had a lot of reactions to it as I went across it. But I think the most important, the kind of the thing that struck me the most was the range of what it is that you do. You go from being so impulsive in terms of your drawings that they just like, you know, they look almost unfinished to these incredibly detailed typographic and almost iconographic figures. What is it about the range and the style of your work that you think makes it so interesting?
I think the range represents a range of moods and emotional states for me and time engagement. So I guess one of the things, because I've gotten to look at these drawings too in a different way, because it represents almost 30 years of drawings that I've done, although it's not all of the things that I've done. It's a selection from that 30 years. But I also get to look back and think, what happened here? What does this mean for me as an artist in terms of what I experienced? And I think one of the things that I've come up with is that there are these just different ways that I've engaged with drawing, but drawing represents a way of thinking for me. So a way of thinking, reacting, it's like shouting without actually using my voice, or it's contemplating quietly, or so there's these different, just as the way that as people, we have different states of being and different kinds of ways that we are as people, that I feel like the drawings represent that range for me.
And you said something else too, because I think one of the things I want to explore with you in this interview is looking at some of the things you said about your artwork. I mean, it's on display in the gallery, so people should go see it. I mean, some of it is phenomenal, but what you've said kind of interests me as well. And one of the things that when I went in and looked at it, and I couldn't put this into words, and then I saw that you had a quote in terms of thinking about your work as an expansion of limited terminology. In other words, it's like the work does things that words can't do. And I found myself trying to, you know, put into words what I was experiencing, but it almost seemed to be, I couldn't do it. And it seems like you think that your work allows for that expansion that I couldn't find.
Well, I think in some ways what you said is you tried to put it into words but couldn't captures what I think is the problem with the English language in terms of complicated situations, especially, you know, racial situations or things that are in gray areas, that they're not black or white. So I grew up as a biracial person in the Buffalo area, and there's just the way that that multiracial experiences are terms in the United States have a lot to do with capitalism. So mulattoes and, you know, that kind of language has to do with how much blood of black people is in you. And it has a lot to do with slaveholding, right? And so it's not really keyed for the person. It's keyed for kind of capitalist purchasing of bodies. So I think in that way, we don't have an English language that's really sensitive to the way people experience really interesting intersections. So I think in that way, what you're saying is English doesn't actually have the words, which is why I moved to making images, because I couldn't find, I was originally interested in writing poetry, and, you know, that was the thing that I was really wanting to do, and I kept coming up across these limitations, English being my main language. So I moved to making images that seemed to capture better the complexity that I couldn't myself put into words, so that you can't put it into the words. But I think the thing that I am interested in is you trying, because our impulse is to try, right?
Yes.
Our impulse is to turn it, to use our mouths and to go like, what? And that to me is the most interesting place, is the attempt. So that you even felt that you wanted to attempt, to me, is that's a successful moment, because it means that you're engaged enough that you want to, like, name. You want to be like, who are you? What's happening here? It's the act of articulation. It could be a failed act, but it's the trying to me that is actually a sign of some vital interaction occurring in that space.
So let me ask you about this thing you call brain to paper. You've said it a couple of places that the way you tend to work brain to paper, that your process is very impulsive. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I guess I say that, and, you know, remembering that I am someone who also teaches what I would call traditional drawing, you know, which involves, I teach at Williams College and I teach introductory drawing classes often. And, you know, part of the expectation often in those classes is the ability to learn how to make the illusion of three-dimensional space in two dimensions, right? So, like, you make an apple that looks like it has sitting in space and there's depth. And, you know, that is one goal of representational drawing that is a perfectly legitimate and wonderful goal and can be really delightful when you achieve it. So I think, though, that what I have done in my own drawing is I have not felt, I haven't felt it necessary to recreate kind of what I am seeing in real life. Like, that to me is not personally my interest in it. My interest is in some ways moving from this interior space to the paper and having that be very direct. And that doesn't mean I can't be representing things that have a real correspondence in real life. Like, I use my own body a lot in the images, but they're not, it's not about realism and it's not about getting things spatially correct, or it's really about a kind of an emotional impact or a conversation with the viewer. And in some ways, the technical, you know, things about making things look realistic, which again is its own kind of success, it's not a conversation that I'm that engaged with. And so I'm really trying to kind of, I don't want you to talk about how nicely, you know, I've captured three-dimensional space. I want to talk about, like, what you're saying. What are you thinking? What are you thinking about what's happening, right? So I think that that is often what I'm trying to cut through something to get to something in the viewer, to get something activated between, I guess, my brain and the viewer, and the paper is the arbiter of that, you know, with that object.
It sort of works as a medium in a way.
Yeah, because you do theater, right? So theater is it's direct, right? I've done theater in the past. I was a near theater major in college, and so that, you know, being able to read your audience, to be in space, right, to have that kind of immediate energy that's present. That's what's so beautiful about live performance, right? Is that you are getting something from the audience and you can feel it. It's very different with object-based art, right? So I make something and I put my energy into it and it goes into this object, and then the object then, you know, ideally has some of that energy that comes from the object, right, mm-hmm. into right. a space. And that is just it's a transference that is different than, you know, I'd like to believe that the energy transference that happens is just differently timed than what happens in live performance. You know what I mean? There's a kind of difference of timing.
Yes.
And maybe it's because I also was so interested in theater for a while that I do, you know, I think about how these objects are behaving in a space without me present, right? So what requires their activation is different, right? So you have to come along and I have to engage you through marks and through a kind of something on that paper, which is going to capture your attention. And it means that I just believe that there's something genuine that I need to be doing that is alive enough that it can come back, right? Come back from that paper. So that's a different, you know, I it's similar, I guess, in some ways to the concerns of all artists. I think we all, you know, crave that or want that in different ways, but our method of going after that is different.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good observation about, you know, what artists want to achieve in the world, how they want to affect, you know, their audiences of whatever type they have. You've spoken also too about your subjects in your artwork in an interesting fashion that when someone like me comes in and looks at them, they have a very, you know, fantastical look to them. And I know some of your work was inspired by the science fiction writer Octavia Butler. And, you know, they look otherworldly in a sense. And yet at the same time, you don't see them as being, you know, fantastical or, you know, creatures from another world or something like that. When you look at how you create these pictures, what are you seeing when you put them on the paper?
That's a very good question. I think, I guess I try to make figures, because I work a lot figuratively. I mean, that's just true. And so I think I try to make figures the way that I want to see them rather than how we are. So I want them to have this shape-shifting freedom that perhaps we don't have that so much in our weighted down, gravity-bound bodies that have to weather a lot of things that we don't have any control over in terms of how our bodies are read by others and with historical frameworks around them. So, yeah, I think a lot of what I'm doing is trying to free the bodies from that, right? Like, so there's a kind of, I know that people used to talk about my work back in, 20 years ago or more as Afrofuturism or, kind of like a move into the future. And I think that there's some truth to that in that I'm trying to move towards something that is not bound, but I also am very aware of the history of our country and what has happened. And so it's not just speculative and totally free. There are things that enter into the drawings that are very aware of what has happened to bodies like the kind that I'm trying to work with.
I think the last question I have for you a lot of times when we get to see artists' work, we get to see something about, what they have been doing in the past and what they've been thinking about in the past and what they were thinking of in the context of the time in which they were doing that particular work. I'm interested in what you're working on now, what we could see in the future from you, and as you look at this almost 30-year retrospective of your work, where do you see it going for the next 20 years or so?
Ooh, 20 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I'm working on now, I've been working on prints more now. I've been working with some various printmakers to come up with prints, and that's been enjoyable for me. So, to be very honest, the work of getting the show, the drawing show together has taken up my past year very heavily. So I haven't had as much time to do the things in the studio that I've wanted to do, but I have been working on different prints, and I finished a group of prints that are, I would call them sort of superhero figures, different than the ones that are in the show. They're really, they're kind of unrecognizable as anything that I have seen related to superheroes, except they have capes. So they're pretty wild, and I haven't actually shown them that much. But those to me, when I'm looking at something like that, which I don't even know, when you talk about you can't name it, and I can't name it either. And I'm like, wow, what did I make? What does that mean? Is this okay? So that is a little bit that's the direction in terms of my goals for myself. My goal is to not fall into a place where I know exactly what I'm doing, but I want to be able to, the best thing for me is when I make things and I'm like, ooh, is that like, what is that? Is that okay? Like, can I, so I do think that is my goal. And to deepen and also to deepen my level of engagement. So for the work to continually sort of ask itself if it's relevant, I have pretty high standards, I guess, for myself for just like, I want to be very proactive about not just being the kind of artist who's putting things out there because I want to stay in the public eye, right? I want to put things out there that feel relevant and connected and vital. And so that's kind of my standard. And so that's what I want to see from my work in the next 20 years is to continually make sure that I am holding to that. And what that's going to look like, I have no idea. I imagine I'm going to work with figures, although the things in my studio right now, the latest paintings I've been working on, they're figurative, but they're almost like landscapes, but figures. So I start to really, I've done this in the past, but I start to really take apart the figure in a way that doesn't feel as recognizable immediately as figure, but I'm still thinking very much about how bodies are interacting.
Well, that's probably going to be very interesting because one of the signature things about your work is the lack of landscape. So to be able to be able to deconstruct the figure to the point where you're creating a landscape with the figure is kind of interesting. It's a different direction to go. I wish you luck with all of that.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for really looking at the drawings. I appreciate the time that you gave to them.
Oh, they were really, it was a time well spent. And I want to really encourage my listening audience to go and take a look at these works because I think they'll have the same reaction as I have that, you know, you look at them and you will be moved by them and you will be inarticulate in front of them. And I think that that's what the whole purpose of the exhibition really is. And I think that's a dangerous place for the viewer to be, but I think it's also a healthy, good place for the viewer to be in terms of, you know, their ability to grow and be more aware of the world we live in. So thank you for the time that you've given me, Leila. I do appreciate that.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Leila Ali's exhibit, Is Anything the Matter?, will continue through April 14th at the Marion Art Gallery at SUNY Fredonia. Ms. Ali will be on the Fredonia campus to give a visiting artist lecture on Friday, March 22nd, from 4 to 5:30 p.m. in McEwen Hall, room 209. Admission is free. Here is a particularly rich and busy arts calendar for the next 2 weeks in the region. I wish I could cover all these events for the podcast, but listing them will have to do for now. You have some fantastic choices over these next 2 weeks to get out and enjoy some wonderful art of all kinds, from jazz to dance. There's something for everyone in these next 2 weeks. Comedian Tammy Pescatelli will be bringing her brand of comedy, including new material for her next one-hour special, on Friday, March 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. Tickets are $25 for adults and $10 for students. These tickets are sure to go fast, so either go online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or call the box office at 716-679-1891 for your tickets now. Comedian Tammy Pescatelli's show is rated PG-13. The cinema series continues with the showing of Perfect Days, an Oscar-nominated film for Best International Feature Film. Starring Koji Yakusho as Hirayama, a toilet cleaner in Tokyo, unexpected encounters reveal his deeply moving and poetic story. Perfect Days screens on Saturday, March 23rd, and Tuesday, March 26th at 7:30 p.m. each night. Tickets are sold at the door only on the night of the screening. The Ecstasis 2.0 Young Artist Recitals continue with a recital on Thursday, March 28th at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House beginning at 5:30 p.m. This juried recital series is a concert initiative created by the Ecstasis Duo, which features selections from both the solo and chamber repertoire performed by the next generation of classical musicians in the inviting and intimate setting of the Opera House. Admission is free. Donations are gratefully accepted.
The Fredonia Dance Ensemble will present its annual dance concert on Friday and Saturday, March 22nd and 23rd. Performances begin at 7:30 p.m. both days, with a matinee performance on Saturday the 23rd at 2 p.m. The event features works from current dance faculty as well as dance alumni. Tickets are available at the campus box office at 716-673-3501 or online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets. The Fredonia Jazz Flextet, featuring Grammy and Tony Award-winning trombonist, composer, and arranger James Burton III, will perform in a concert featuring his compositions and arrangements under the direction of Dr. Nick Weiser on Friday, March 22nd, beginning at 8 p.m. in the Rausch Recital Hall at SUNY Fredonia. Admission is free. The Music of Donald Bolin 90th Birthday Celebration will take place on Saturday, March 23rd, beginning at 4:30 p.m. in the Rausch Recital Hall. The celebration will feature performances of the music of SUNY Professor Emeritus Donald Bolin, who was Professor of Composition from 1974 to 2007. Admission to the event is free and open to the public. The Fredonia College Symphony, under the baton of Dr. Emily Schad, and featuring the concerto competition winner Che Dixon on cello, will perform in the King Concert Hall on Saturday, March 23rd, beginning at 8 p.m. Admission is free. The Western New York Chamber Orchestra will present a concert featuring soloists from around the world, sponsored by the Kahl Orchestra Project. Under the baton of Maestro Glenn Cortese, soloists from Brazil, China, France, and the U.S. will perform selections from the classical repertoire. Tickets are $20 general admission and free for students in advance, or $15 at the door. And finally, Main Street Studios will present the classic whodunit, Clue, on Thursday through Saturday, March 28th through 30th, and again the following weekend, Friday and Saturday, April 5th through 6th. For more information about showtimes and tickets, visit their website at www.mainstreetstudios.org. And remember, if you have an arts event that you'd like to get on the arts calendar, just call 716-679-1891 with your information, or email to operahouse@fredopera.org, and we'll include your event. Please give us a month's notice in advance, if possible, to ensure a timely mention. The Bach and Beyond Festival, for many reasons, will be giving its final performances on June 14th through 16th of this year. Long a staple of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House season, the festival will sunset with the 2024 edition. I wanted to give Mr. Rick Davis, Executive Director of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House, an opportunity to elaborate on the reasons for the festival's discontinuation, so I invited him on the podcast to offer more details. I'm joined now by the Executive Director of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House, Mr. Rick Davis. Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. We appreciate you doing the job that you do on our podcast, and it's always a pleasure to come join you.
Oh, listen, I'm glad to do it. You rescued me from oblivion, so I mean,
oh, someone else would have snapped you right up in your retirement.
Well, I wanted to bring you onto the podcast this week because I know that recently, I think probably earlier in the month, beginning of March, you sent out a letter and also it made its way into the papers that the Bach and Beyond Festival will be celebrating its last appearance at the Opera House, as always, during the first week in June. And that's a major event as far as the festival is concerned, the Opera House is concerned, because it's been around for quite some time, and you know, seeing it go is obviously a little bit disappointing to, you know, fans of the festival. And it's become such a regional arts event that I'm sure it will be missed, but I think perhaps you can talk a little bit about the circumstances surrounding this situation.
Yes, and you're correct. It's probably one of our signature events. It has been held here at the Opera House since the Opera House reopened after our restoration in 1995. This this will be the 27th festival in that time. And we wrestled with the decision to sunset the festival. It was not one we came to easily. And I will say we have heard from a number of fans of the festival who are disappointed to hear that it won't be continuing after this year. We're disappointed as well. And but there's good sound reasoning behind it. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk about that a little bit. Basically, the decision came down to a few factors: the cost of the festival and the lack of support for it, both in terms of finances as well as attendance, the difficulty in mounting the festival and some of the unique challenges that we have for this, the way this particular festival is run, and the changing nature of the festival over the years and the impact that that has had on our logistics. So let me elaborate a little bit on some of that. I should first say that the Bach Festival has never relied solely and been able to be mounted solely based on ticket sales to the festival. It's the cost is just too great. It's the most expensive program that we present here at the Opera House. It also, for many, many years, was one of the most sponsored programs. We relied heavily on sponsorships from a few small businesses and from individual donors who have supported it from the beginning. Many of those sponsors have passed away. They have moved away. They have become ill to the point of they are now residing in nursing homes, and which is, I should not chuckle, it's not a funny thing, but they've been with us for that long. They're now in nursing homes and they don't have the ability to provide sponsorships. And there has not been new sponsorships coming to take their place. So it is not supported financially as it has always been. And that's a challenge. There are also a different set of costs that have arisen over the years. Grant Cooper, who since the beginning has been the artistic director and conductor for the festival, when he was artistic director at West Virginia Symphony, which is almost the whole time that he has been working with us on the festival, we were able to rely on the music library of the symphony and therefore not have any costs for music rental and music purchases. Grant retired from West Virginia Symphony a few years ago. Since that time, that was 2017, I believe, since that time, we have had music rental costs. This past festival, those exceeded $900, which seems like not like a lot of money, but when you haven't had that cost in the past, it is. We also have relied heavily on a core group of musicians over the years who come in to play with us every festival, and they're here for the week. Many of them have been local musicians, and we still have local musicians. I don't want to make this sound like nobody is local. Most of our local musicians come in and play for one piece, or so their commitment to us is minimal. Our core musicians who are with us for the entire week of rehearsals and all three performances, and they are in the, they do the solos and they do the small chamber ensemble pieces and they do the full orchestral pieces. There's only one at this point who is a local musician. This means that everybody else is coming from away. We have travel costs associated with that, and we have housing issues associated with that. And that's one of the unique things about the festival, our festival, that has always enabled us to present the festival. We don't pay to house our musicians. We ask and have always had good support from festival supporters, from board members, from volunteers who have been willing to house our musicians at their homes the entire week that they are here, through the rehearsals, through the performances. They stay there, they get a little breakfast in the morning, they come and spend the day here rehearsing. And it's been a wonderful thing. It's a huge cost avoidance for us. That has become more and more difficult with the increased number of musicians, with the loss of many of our longtime supporters, and understandably since COVID, even those supporters who are still here, some are reluctant to invite people into their homes for an entire week. So last year, we had to house 10 such musicians. We ended up paying for two of them to be housed at the college, a discounted rate, and we appreciate the college for doing that, but a cost that we didn't really have budgeted for to begin with. This year, as an example, moving forward planning for 2024, I already know that the sites that we used for six of those 10 musicians are unavailable to house musicians this year. So we're already behind the eight ball trying to scramble to find housing. And that's a search that begins in January with the festival in June. So that logistically, that's become more difficult. And we've added the cost of travel costs to more and more musicians. At the same time, attendance has declined. 2002 was our high point. We had 631 people attending the total of the three concerts. That's an average attendance of 210 people, if my math is correct, for each of the three concerts. Last year's festival, the total was 263 people for three concerts, an average attendance of 88 people. So the ticket sales has drastically declined over the years as well. So we've got less money coming in and more expense going out on this festival. Last year, we lost almost $12,000 in presenting the festival. The year before, we lost not as much, but still a significant loss. All of this has kind of come together, and in consultation with Maestro Cooper and with the board, it's been determined that the festival really is not sustainable financially. And that was really what prompted the decision to sunset the festival and make this our last festival. This is the 27th festival, our last one. I should also note that we've been very fortunate over the years to receive grant funding from the New York State Council on the Arts. And for a long, long time, that grant funding was dedicated to supporting just the festival. We no longer receive grant funding dedicated just to the festival as we did. Now that funding from NISCA, they have changed the way that they award funding. It has to be spread out over more events, more programs, more activity. It can't be relied on just to bail out the festival any financial losses, so to speak. And we don't know from year to year really what level of support we are going to get from NISCA. We're fortunate that it has increased since COVID. But that may not continue. We don't know. This year, Governor Hochul, for example, has proposed a budget for the state that cuts local aid support for the arts through the New York State Council on the Arts in half. People are lobbying, arts organizations are lobbying right now to have that funding restored through the legislature, and we're hopeful that that will happen. But if there are cuts made, surely those cuts will be passed on to the support to the individual arts organization. So that cannot be relied on going forward. So that's some of the specifics and some of the details and the level of issues that we've been looking at and frankly discussing for several years now at the board level, and also with Grant Cooper. Grant, by the way, was disappointed that the festival may not be continuing, but certainly supported that decision, and has been really wonderful in working through it with us.
Well, that's a lot to absorb at one shot, Rick. It's a lot of information, and I just want to ask you just this particular question: when you look at the tea leaves, and just in relationship to the overall art scene alone, what are you personally seeing as someone who has to deal with these issues on a day-to-day basis?
Well, that's a really good question, and I can share some information, two bits of information about that. Prior to the pandemic, 2019 was the last full normal year before COVID. Our attendance topped 12,000 people over the course of the calendar year. In 2023, we almost got to 9,000. So big, what's that? A quarter down, 25% less?
Something basically. Like that, yeah, basically. Yep.
From what it had been before COVID. And we're not really presenting many fewer events. The level of programming is almost what it was prior to COVID, but the attendance is not there. Last year was better than the year before. We're hoping this year will be better than last year and so on. We're hoping this is a trend moving upward. So we consider ourselves fortunate that we've rebounded as well as we have. And although we're not back yet to where we were, we count our blessings and we look for interesting programs and hope to have people respond favorably to them. I should mention, too, that's one of the things that's the attitude we're trying to take with this last Bach festival.
Yes,
We think it's going to be a great festival. We're offering a couple of additional events as part of the festival. Maestro Cooper's theme this year is one of comparisons and kind of competition, looking at three different composers from around the Baroque era: Wolfgang Mozart, Chevalier, Antonio Salieri, all kind of contemporaries in competition with one another. And the question that Grant is asking is, who was the better composer, truly? So we're each concert program will have a major work from one of those three composers. And prior to the festival, the weekend prior to the festival, we're screening two movies: Amadeus, the best picture winner from 1985, looking at Mozart, and a more recent film from 2022, Chevalier, looking at the Chevalier de Saint-Georges. And unfortunately, there's not one on Salieri, but he plays heavily in Amadeus.
He does, yes. A lot of people say that movie's actually about Salieri and not about Mozart.
Well, good. So we're getting two in one there. Oh, and of course, F. Murray Abraham he was nominated for an Oscar for that performance.
Yes, he was. It's a fantastic movie.
Great movie. So we're screening both of those films on Saturday, June 8th, the weekend prior to the festival. As kind of a little bit of preparation for that. And then, as I said, a major work from each of those composers throughout the festival. We're also celebrating, I'm really excited about this. We have one musician, in addition to Grant, we have one musician who has been with the festival all 26 years and will be here for the 27th, our oboist, Cheryl Bischoff. And composer Byron Adams is working on a piece that will be an oboe piece that Cheryl will give the world premiere of this piece at our festival.
Good for and her.
We're really, really, and that's our way of kind of celebrating Cheryl and her commitment to the festival and her longevity with the festival over the years. And she's an incredible oboist. We all love her dearly. And so that's our way of paying tribute to Cheryl, our sole remaining musician from the beginning.
That's great. Well, I'm glad that you and Maestro Cooper have something going that's going to send the festival out with a bang. It deserves everything that, you know, that will hope. And I hope people will come out, you know, for this one last time and give it the send off that it really deserves, because it's been such an institution and, you know, it's been a lot of fun. And I know there's a couple of events you got coming up. We've got Tammy Pescatelli coming up. How are tickets going for her?
Yeah, Tammy Pescatelli is Friday, March 22nd. And this coming Friday, I liken her humor to Pete Corielli, our own Fredonia's Pete Corielli. It's observational. It comments on life. It comments on family, and but with a little more sass than Pete. and she wants me to, if I talk to people about it, she wants people to be aware that it's probably a PG-13 show. So while she talks about family, it's not for fam. For adults.
Okay, for adults. PG-13. Okay, we've got that. And I'm sure you want to remind people about the Run for the Opera House, because that's coming up pretty soon, actually, when you think
Our
about it.
Our run is at the end of April. Yes, April 28th, Sunday, April 28th, 9 a.m. is the 7th annual 1891 Run for the Opera House. You don't have to run. You can walk. You can be an armchair runner, which is what we call our donors, where you don't have to run or walk. You could just donate money. we're always happy to accept that. But we're excited about it. People have been registering for about a month and a half now, and it's just a generally good time. We really enjoy it. It's a great way to be outside early on a Sunday morning in April. One year we had a little snow, one year we had a little rain. I'm optimistic, given the way our winter's been this far, that it's going to be 90 degrees.
Okay. You know?
we'll be in the middle of summer at the end of April.
I hope so. I hope so. Yes, that's for sure. All right, Rick, listen, I got to let you go, unfortunately.
Thank you.
But really, thanks for bringing us up to date on what's going on. We appreciate that. So that, you know, we know as a listening audience what's going on. And we'll probably get in touch with you, who knows, sometime perhaps when the next season starts, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Thanks, Tom.
Okay. Thanks, Rick. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tickets for all the Bach and Beyond Festival events are now on sale online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or at the box office at 716-679-1891. You can also sign up for the 1891 Run for the Opera House as well by visiting the website and clicking on the 1891 Run button at the top of the page. And that's it for this Ostara edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Don Marazzo, Leila Ali, and Rick Davis for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.com. arts.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice, if possible, to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode will be available on Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another.